Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey, on November 13, 2018. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Salatha Sutta, also known as the Sutta of the Two Arrows. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace. The Salatha Sutta. This sutta, it's one of those suttas that I come back to often and mention it often. I think I last taught this sutta, though, was December of last year, so it's been a while. And if you've had a chance to read it, I revised it slightly, added a little bit more commentary and to make it a little bit more clear, relate more closely to what the Buddha taught. The whole misunderstanding of dukkha or suffering and the natural aversion to a mind rooted in ignorance has towards dukkha has led to much of the misunderstanding in modern Buddhism and other practices. And so suffering or dukkha is often presented as something to be to escape from. And so there's all kinds of different practices, both meditation practices and ritualistic practices, to escape from dukkha. The Buddha teaches something so radically different, doesn't he, to understand it. And in understanding, we neither have aversion for it or affinity for it either. Some schools of modern Buddhism teach us to embrace our dukkha. Well, the Buddha never taught us to embrace it either, which is simply another form of clinging. And it really is another way of manipulating our experience with the common with dukkha, the common experience of life, rather than, as the Buddha teaches, to understand it. And it is understanding the nature of dukkha that we're able to surpass it in the way we relate to it. Not escape, not embracing it, simply understanding it. And in the sutta, the Buddha teaches that that is a defining difference between one who is, in the words, the translated words, uninformed, meaning uninformed of Four Noble Truths, and those that have developed the Four Noble Truths. They understand the nature of suffering. In the Salatha Sutta, a question is put to the Buddha as to what is the distinguishing factor between a well-instructed and well-informed Dhamma practitioner and those that have no understanding of the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha responds, "Friends, listen and pay close attention. An ordinary uninformed person feels feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, and neutral or ambiguous feelings. One well-informed of the Four Noble Truths also feels feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, and neutral feelings. When, through the sixth sense base, an uninformed person experiences a feeling of pain, they are sorrowful, they grieve, they become distraught and irate." Remember the series we just went through on the wisdom of restraint. It is at that point of contact with our senses that a well-informed person knows that's where we practice restraint, rather than becoming sorrowful or grieve or become distraught and irate. "The uninformed feels two pains, the physical pain of the experience and the mental pain caused by the reaction arising from clinging to views ignorant of Four Noble Truths. This would be like being hit with an arrow and then, by request, being hit again by another arrow," that mental component, the reaction to the experience. Skipping over some of my commentary. The Buddha continues, "As the person is experiencing pain, pain resistance occurs." That's an important and interesting line, isn't it? By reacting to pain, we create a resistance to it, rather than simply understanding that as a consequence of having a human life, there will be painful experiences, in which case there's no reaction, and there's no obsession. In this case, it would likely be aversion, although in some people, there is obsession for further painful experiences, and they create scenarios to have that, which reinforces their views of themselves in the world. And that's getting a little bit psychological. But
what do you mean by resistance?
Resistance in this case is any reaction in the mind that wants an experience to be different than what occurs. So, and it, the obvious choice is that I don't want this that is occurring, meaning that you have personalized it.
Well, why is this happening to me?
Mm-hmm. And many people, I shouldn't say many, I think most people personalize any type of disappointment, whether it's an extreme level of suffering or just they want something to be different. And that's always personalized, isn't it? Because all of these things that the Buddha describes as dukkha, let me, you know, I might as well reiterate that. The Buddha describes dukkha as or stress. Birth is stressful, aging is stressful, sickness is stressful, death is stressful. Not getting what is desired is stressful. Getting what is undesired is stressful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful, meaning that the ongoing personal experience of the five clinging aggregates is stressful. Being the five clinging aggregates describe a view of self that is rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And so it continually churning up and reinforcing unsatisfying experiences. So that reaction, once it's established, is continued through clinging to that initial desire that I want this to be different than it is. And that's in any situation. And on very subtle levels, we gain the ability to understand the difference between approval and acceptance. Most of us have those things hardwired together. In other words, in order for me to accept something, I think that I also have to approve it as being good or bad. When the truth is that the things that occur in life, that arise and pass away, all the conditioned things in life, as Kandana recognized, are impersonal, that is made personal, the point of this sutta, by reaction to it, by personalizing it, by wanting it to be different than it is, by thinking that it's only happening to you, or at least in that moment. So does that answer your great, important question too? Leading to resistance obsession. As a person experiences pain, obsession and sensual pleasure occurs. And so obsession is often thought of as only as desire, meaning I would want more of it. But obsession is also aversion, isn't it? And it can rise to extreme levels of obsessive aversion, which is clinical levels of anxiety, isn't it? Rising from that initial reaction. And people that are suffering from clinical anxiety, I've got to be very careful. This is not likely an immediate cure for that. In other words, don't stop anything else you're doing and just do this. Talk to whoever you're talking to. Reaction brings obsession as the uninformed does not understand what is actually present. What is actually present is the origination, the allure, even the aversion is allure, the drawback and the passing away of the feeling. In other words, we only experience the initial reaction to it, and we miss the arising of it, the occurrence, the establishment of it in our mind. But if we took another breath or two, we would recognize the passing away, or we would understand the impermanence of it. And doing jhana, another reason why I'm teaching this sutta now, is the perfect metaphor, but also the perfect practical experience of the arising and passing away of all phenomena. Lorna brought this up a few times. It's so important. In proper meditation, shamatha vipassana meditation, we're not simply mindful of the breath. We're mindful of both cycles of the breath, the in-breath and the out-breath, the arising and the passing away. And that's a direct experience of the arising and passing away of all phenomena. And as we learn it on our cushions, we're able to take it off our cushions and recognize it in all situations and maintain that level of jhana, that level of concentration that we establish in our meditation practice. Excuse me. Is that clear? Because that's really the practical reason why we meditate for deepening concentration, so that off our cushion we're not distracted by wanting things to be different than they are, by reaction. The Buddha describes an awakened mind as calm and at peace, no matter what's occurring. And that means we have a calm and peaceful mind no matter what's occurring in the world around us. The origination, the allure, the drawback, and the passing away of the feeling. As the uninformed does not understand the origination, the allure, the drawback, and the passing away of the feeling, then any ignorance, obsession with regards to this feeling of pain, pleasure, or neither pleasure nor pain, overcomes and obsesses them. The obsession is wanting something to be different than it is. Now, and isn't that a perfect description of obsession? Most of us have it tied to addiction or very overt levels of compulsive behavior, but it's anything that occurs in our minds that's rooted in clinging, that something be different than it is, rooted in craving. It's obsession. And that obsession overcomes and further obsesses them. Skip over my comment. The Buddha continues, sensing pleasure or pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, The uninformed, through self-reference or personalizing their experience, my words, joins with it. That's what Buddha often describes. The problem of dukkha is that we join with it through identifying to it. It's mind. How was your day? Oh, my day was awful. Well, it was just another day within the continuance of dukkha, wasn't it? The uninformed is joined to birth, aging, sickness, death, and joined with sorrow, regret, pain, and despair. Through reaction to the experience, the uninformed joins with and furthers their confusion and suffering. I'm going to read it again. Through reaction to the experience, the uninformed joins with and furthers their confusion and suffering. That reaction is the second arrow, isn't it? And it's our choice. Often our minds are so conditioned that we don't recognize that we have a choice in reacting or not reacting, maintaining a calm and peaceful mind. And that is the ignorance that continues to obscure the problem. That's the reason why the Buddha taught an Eightfold Path, including a very specific meditation practice, to recognize and practice restraint at that point of reaction. That's what an informed person does. And they do it not because I said it or the Buddha said to do it. We do it because it's a natural response to integrating the Eightfold Path. That's so important, what I just said.
I'm not raising it. To integrate the Eightfold Path.
It's not because someone told you that this is what you should do. It's because you do it because it's a natural expression of integrating the Eightfold Path. You do it because it's in your own best interest to do it, not because somebody said to do it. Of course, we all learn this way. We first learn from either reading something or listening to somebody explain something, hopefully clear enough that you can utilize it. But what I'm teaching, what the Buddha's teaching, is this is to be developed within us so that we don't react anymore. And we do that, we develop that level of profound mindfulness through integrating the entire Eightfold Path, resting in the concentration developed in Shamatha Vipassana meditation. That's so important. And it's one of the things that I alluded to earlier. Much of New Age, I'll go that broad, and then I'll refine it to spiritual practice and then even find it to Buddhist practice. The methods taught are not taught to integrate the Eightfold Path so as to understand suffering and our contributions to suffering. They're taught to either further ignorance of it, of suffering, or to avoid it completely. And that those would be practices that are appealing to disincarnate deities to deliver us from our suffering. Very similar to most religions, aren't they? Again, I'm not putting it down. The Buddha taught a way of directly understanding the common human problem of suffering. And it is in that way that we develop the Eightfold Path. The uninformed joins with and furthers their confusion and suffering. Now the Buddha is going to teach what a well-informed person does. The well-informed person, when stress arises, has no resistance. Isn't that a marvelous place to be? Because stress is going to arise. The First Noble Truth states that, doesn't it? But when it arises, because of our own understanding of the nature of stress, the nature of suffering, we have no resistance to it or reaction to it. It's simply part of the flow. In fact, I would say the mundane flow of life. There's nothing remarkable about it because we understand that it's part and parcel of having a human life. And there's nothing personal about it either unless we decide to personalize it. The well-informed person, when stress arises, has no resistance. With no resistance, no resistance obsession is formed. And another word for resistance obsession is the manifold strategies that we develop to ignore our own ignorance. We're obsessed with continuing that way of thinking that only reinforces reaction. Resistance obsession. How can I get out of this? Any thought along those lines is, what did I do wrong? What can I do different? How can I avoid this? How can I create a situation in my life where I'm shielded from any possible negative situation? That's resistance obsession, isn't it?
So the first arrow can't be avoided.
The first arrow can't be avoided.
It's the perversion that occurs with the second arrow.
Yes, the right word there, perversion or fabrication, that there's something we did wrong or that we can do to not suffer sickness, aging, death, to not suffer not getting what we want or getting what we don't want.
So with wisdom, you come to understand impermanence and not self, and then it just washes over you.
Yes.
It's the foam, it's the cloud, it's the trick.
Yes,
you,
yes.
You realize that that's what it is.
Yeah, and yeah, and you point out something so important. It's understanding the impermanence, the three marks of existence, impermanence, the not self-characteristic, meaning misunderstood, ignorant views of self, resulting in that third mark of suffering. Everything, the insight that the Buddha taught was specific to the three marks of existence so that we can understand our own existence, isn't it? And you could say that the third mark, dukkha, encapsulates the first two, and it's the result of the first two. So
it's
when you understand...
understanding of it. It's not, you're not avoiding it, you're not lessening it, it's just understanding it.
Yes, at such a profound level. But also profound, but also a very simple level, isn't it? Because simple meaning it's simply what is occurring. But because we are so inclined towards distraction rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths, we can't and won't see it. And the strategy that we use is reaction or ongoing resistance obsession.
So if the first arrow comes, and it will, but it's something that you do need to respond to, you just do it with a calmer understanding.
Yes.
And don't take it personally. You just think about what needs to be done next and do it.
And you respond in a very skillful way, in a way that won't contribute at all to the furthering of any more suffering for yourself or others if they're involved in that situation. It, again, it's not an escape from suffering, and certainly it's not an escape from the world, worldly events, which is what a lot of practices have us remove our minds from our body. The Buddha teaches us how to stay mindfully present with no reaction in our body as our life unfolds. And the great reward is just that. We actually get to live our life in the way that it's occurring, in the way that it's the common occurrence for every single human being. And think about that, the profundity of that. Think about how that allows us to have a completely fulfilling life, no matter what the outer circumstances might be. Why? Because we're actually living a life without the need for it to be any different. And so we can, just to use the word, don't pick apart my word too quickly, so we can enjoy everything that's occurring because we're immersed in it, whether it's sorrowful, painful, joyful, blissful, they're all the same. They don't cause a disturbance in our mind, and so we're able to be completely immersed in the moment and not distracted out of the moment or out of our bodies, out of our minds, by the need for it to be any different or to be over with or to get to the next piece of chocolate cake because this one was so good.
And it will be with ease.
With ease. Yeah, with a gentle ease.
Now getting the whole medicine, you know. It'll be with ease because you're not spending your energy fighting against it.
Yes.
You can just do what needs to be done directly without distraction. It just gets done.
Skip
yes.
Foaming at the mouth.
Yes. The difficult thing is we are so conditioned, confirmation bias, that aspect of it, to think that because we take something personal that we must do something, even if it's just in our minds, to get out of this or not ever have the experience of it again in any possible way. And so a lot of us fill up our hut with coconuts because we're so afraid that we might lose all our coconuts. We get so many coconuts in our hut that we're sleeping on coconuts now rather than the cool earth. Is that a good enough visual? I hope so. Because it's really what we do. And we do this both with physical things. You know, the bigger house, the newer car, the right friends or the right whatever it might be, the associations. But we also do it, and I think it's more debilitating, we do it with ideology, that we hold concepts in our mind that we think will insulate us against worldly events. And the reason why I say that's even more debilitating because then we can attach those through association to other people that are thinking like that. And through common agreement, like the Buddha teaches in the Kalama Sutta, we become enamored with these views that are simply a very deep and profound level of distraction or ignorance, rather than the direct approach that the Buddha teaches to recognize and abandon our reaction to craving and clinging, to dukkha. To understand at that profound level the three marks of existence. Is that clear?
Mm-hmm.
And so again, remember the Salatha Sutta. The Buddha's teaching the difference between an uninformed person, an uninformed person is not just people who have no spiritual practice. It could be people that have a so-called spiritual practice, but it's not rooted in developing the understanding of Four Noble Truths and integrating the Eightfold Path. Not putting anybody down that's not doing that. The Buddha is teaching something that's very specific. Somebody brought something up, Drew. And I think I missed really what he was going with. He was talking about there's other awakened people in the world besides the Buddha. And leave that word aside and say there were other enlightened people in the world besides the Buddha. And yes, there are. We can go down a whole list of people that we would classify as enlightened. And that contributed greatly to the common good of humanity. But the Buddha was singular in this one path towards his own view of awakening. And his own view of awakening that is exclusive of anything else I've ever really come across in this way as an Eightfold Path is to understand the nature of suffering. To not philosophize it away, to not try to legislate it away, which we found to be probably more hurtful than anything else, or to imagine it away by creating imaginary states relating to the Buddha's search, the ignoble search and the noble search. Any establishment of ourselves in non-physical realms is a reaction to dukkha. Lauren and I had a great discussion about this, and I meant to talk about this last week, so let me just touch on it briefly. I got so involved in talking about these non-physical realms, such as the dimension of infinite consciousness, the dimension of neither perception nor non-perception, the dimension of infinite space. Those are, excuse me, those are all commonly taught practices to establish ourselves in as a culmination of the path. Alara Kalama and Udaka Ramaputta taught similar establishments. The Buddha recognized those and abandoned them. But any establishment in a non-physical realm is seeing ourselves in a conceptual point of view, meaning I am superior now because I'm doing this most wonderful diet. Or I am superior now because I am part of a certain political ideology. Or I'm part of a certain group, the local Elks. And even whether you're seeing that as superior or not, the self-establishment, and I don't know if you're going to follow me here, is establishment in a non-physical realm, isn't it? Because it's in your imagination that you've done it. And we take comfort through distraction by doing that. And that's common, whether it's establishment, using the establishment as an elk, just as an example. But I did it for many, many years as a Tibetan Buddhist and as a Zen Buddhist and as a certain type of meditation practitioner and as a follower of a certain teacher. Those were all establishments, excuse me, in non-physical realms, because they were all happening in my head. It was an imagination. There was no true reality in it, except that outwardly I was practicing something. But inwardly, I had now created a non-physical establishment of myself in this ideal. Is that clear? So what I talked about last week, I'm adding to tonight, just to make that clear, that anytime we establish ourselves in an ideal, we're establishing ourselves in something that is non-physical. In other words, it's not rooted in reality. I don't want to go any further with that. If there's a question about that, what I just said, please bring it up. I'm going to go back to one paragraph. The well-informed person, when stress arises, has no resistance. With no resistance, no resistance obsession is formed, including the resistance obsession that would have us establish ourselves in non-physical realms or imaginary ideologies. They feel only one pain, the physical pain, but not mental. Just as if they were shot with an arrow, but not another, they would feel only one pain, the physical pain. And as we know, physical pain in that way is simply impermanent. It arises and passes away. And even in a practical sense, for most beings, most human beings, any physical pain is impermanent, although some of us have pain that lasts longer than others. But we've also found that mindfulness properly applied helps with even that, doesn't it? I don't want to go too deep into that. The Buddha continues, with no delight or reaction in sensual pleasure, no pleasure obsession occurs. The well-informed person understands what is actually present and understands its origination, its allure, its drawbacks, and its passing away. They do not become sorrowful, regretful, or distraught. They remain disjoined from pleasure and pain. Disjoined from pleasure and pain. We don't join with it. We don't embrace it. We don't create aversion to it or strategies to avoid it. We are disjoined from it. If we are truly disjoined from it, from dukkha, we wouldn't do anything else with it. The Buddha continues, the well-instructed person understands what is actually present and understands its origination, its allures, its drawbacks, and the passing away. They do not become sorrowful, regretful, or distraught. They remain disjoined from pleasure and pain. The well-instructed person, understanding dukkha, does not generate a mental reaction to pain, pleasure, or neither pleasure nor pain. This is the distinction between those informed, those uninformed, and those well-informed of the Four Noble Truths. A well-instructed person who has developed the heartwood of the Dhamma, meaning the Eightfold Path, understands the arising and passing away of all phenomena. As David alluded to, understanding the three marks of existence. My commentary here. This also relates to meditation and remaining mindful of the arising and passing away of the breath and the body, what I mentioned before. Obsession with what is stressful causes one to become stuck in a feedback loop only focused on the arising of the stressful experience and not having that experience of the arising and the passing away, being present with it. Shamatha-vipassana meditation is the singular meditation taught for the sole purpose to develop the concentration necessary to remain mindful of the arising and passing away of the breath and the body. From this well-concentrated foundation, one can then clearly notice the arising, the allure, the path, the drawbacks, and the passing away of ordinary phenomena, and avoid becoming obsessed with and stuck to only the arising of ordinary phenomena. In other words, when we react to anything, we are joining to it. We are becoming stuck to it. Noticing the arising, the allure, the drawbacks, and the passing away of ordinary phenomena is also taught as the four foundations of mindfulness. You remember the beginning instruction for meditation in the four foundations of mindfulness, to notice the breath in the body, to notice the arising and passing away of feelings and thoughts, and to notice that quality of mind that results from reaction or not to feelings and thoughts. That's part of what the Buddha is referring to here. The Buddha continues, craving and aversion no longer distract the mind or continue ignorance. Craving and aversion no longer distract the mind or continue ignorance. So any craving or aversion, which is really two sides of the same coin, can only continue ignorance. And Helen brought up earlier, wanting anything to be different than it is, wanting more of something or less of something, or to avoid something, is craving and aversion. It can only distract the mind or continue ignorance. Approval and rejection are dismissed. They are no longer in existence. Now, no dust remains. Remember how the Buddha decided to finally start teaching the Dhamma? When he had that thought that there's a few people that have just a little dust in their eyes. Those are the ones that can grasp the Dhamma and develop it. And so he decided to get up from under his tree, his sitting position, and start teaching. Now, no dust remains, or sorrow, or regret either. For those that understand the Dhamma, they have left behind becoming further ignorant and have arrived at the far shore of awakening. That's the end of the sutta. They have arrived at the far shore of awakening by simply becoming well-informed Dhamma practitioners. And that's one of the reasons why I say this is a very simple path. It's not always easy. And there's many challenges along the way, but the path itself is very simple and direct. It's unambiguous in any way. So thank you for listening. Let's just go around the room and see what questions you might have. So, Lorna, good to see you.
Good to be here, thank you. Thank you for your teaching. I read it at home this afternoon, and so I kind of knew what I was walking into tonight. The real point of this sutra is that there are two points to receive dukkha. There's the actual thing that you come up against in life, which could offer dukkha to you, and your resistance to it, your how you think about it.
Yep.
So there's but the point I'm trying to get at is that I haven't ever been, to my knowledge, I haven't ever been sufficiently quiet enough in my mind to see two points of stress arising from one occasion, which is what the Buddha teaches. He's,
mm-hmm.
you know, there's two points of stress arising from one incident.
Yep.
There's the incident, and there's your reaction to the incident. When I go about my daily life, I'm not sufficiently clear in my thinking to see that. Although I think I understand the teaching and how it's described it and how it arises. You've mentioned you've mentioned one thing in a lot of different ways, that how you can see your reaction, your own reaction. Some people, I think, can see it through wishing life to be different than it is. I can see things that way sometimes. I can see when I'm making fabrications in my own mind, which we talked about last week. I'm beginning to get better at that. But I haven't in the past put it to this sort of situation. So I think this class tonight has just opened a little door for me, for me to do a little bit more homework and a little bit more observation of my own thinking of why I'm feeling stressed and the origination of the stress, including the thing that actually happened and the thing that I'm thinking about, that, you know, wanting it to be different or... it's been a good teaching, a good night for me, because it's something I've kind of maybe just skipped over a bit in the past in my thinking, so I think maybe tonight is, it might just sort of lay in there a little bit tonight, but this teaching, I think it's been good.
Thank you. And that's the point of the teaching, isn't it? To bring us to an ever deeper understanding of how to apply the Dhamma, how to apply these. And so by gaining the ability to recognize reaction leading to the second arrow, we're gaining a deeper understanding of the nature of dukkha.
Yeah.
The whole, and that points directly to awakening, doesn't it? As the Buddha describes awakening. Profound right view is a profound and penetrative understanding of suffering. Just like the talks and the suttas on developing jhana, so now you'll recognize at an even deeper level in your meditation practice that you're doing that to deepen jhana, to deepen meditation. So from this sutta, you can take it as a little deeper understanding on how to recognize, how am I creating dukkha in my life? How am I creating or adding to this suffering that is common in human life? And that's the point of it. You know, that's why the Buddha teaches, that's why I teach, that's why we have a Sangha, to understand this, just this point. And to understand the distinction of an uninformed person and someone well-informed, meaning simply as a Dhamma practitioner. A well-informed Dhamma practitioner develops a Dhamma, you know, just like this, so we understand this. So thank you. Matt, good to see you.
Good to see you, John. Good to see everybody. There's something in Taoist parlance, they say, cultivating bland. Huh. And this is, I think, speaks to that.
Where?
Whether there's pleasure or pain arises with me as the context. So as soon as I go, oh, I like that, or oh, I don't like that, I've created a value of both, each of those things. And the more that I value one over another, the more I'm stuck to that satisfaction or disappointment.
Yes, yeah. And that position that you've just taken.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So in that cultivating bland is that neither of them are more valuable than the other. Anything that's good, pleasurable, satisfactory is equivalent to something that is disappointing,
yeah,
stressful. And that ability to not identify with either of those things. Something's occurring, it's occurring. I can recognize pleasure and experience the arising and passing away of it.
Yeah.
I can recognize a painful experience, a disappointing, a stressful experience, the arising and passing away of it. And I'm not provoked to react to either. Cultivating bland.
Yeah. That was the right word, provoked either. Well, it's almost sacrilege. It's almost antithetical to the way we're taught we should be looking at life, meaning we should enamored.
Passionate.
Yeah, passionate.
Yeah.
We should be in love with that. And that was kind of one of the things the Buddha came up against. And he realized that what we should be passionate about is awakening, maintaining a calm and peaceful mind, because the things that we are not bland about or passionate about are ever-changing and ephemeral. There's nothing there. And yet we keep trying to find happiness in that which we are conditioned towards, believing that that is what we should be doing.
But it's not so much about not recognizing when something tastes good or something tastes bitter, as much, in this is my understanding, as much as the clinging or getting stuck that everything should be sweet or everything,
yeah,
nothing should be bitter. So in the moment, you enjoy what you like.
Deeply.
You recognize what you don't like, but you don't get stuck.
Yeah.
To me, that getting stuck is...
That's just
is
it.
What you...
Yeah, and another word for stuck would be conditioned towards wanting something to be this certain way. That word bland really describes it, but I think it's hard for people to accept that because we're conditioned against bland.
Right.
But when we can see things, another word for that would be equanimity. An experience that is inherently pleasing to any human being will be pleasing at a much deeper and profound level without the need to have more of it, whatever it is.
Dispassionate.
Dispassionate. Mm-hmm. But that's another word that people have aversion to because we're conditioned to think we should be passionate. I mean, I'm not going to mention a teacher, but many of you had read his books and probably listened to some of his talks because we're all part of that same generation. And he taught... And I still think he had a lot of good things to say. And I'm not going to mention his name. But he taught that we should follow those things that we are most passionate about. Mm-hmm. And there's some wisdom in that. But when we take it to the point of self-identification, we're simply creating more distraction. Mm-hmm. And that kind of goes back to what Drew. This is an example of who I would say is an enlightened being, but not enlightened in the way that the Buddha was. Didn't understand that what we really should be striving for is blandness and that mind of equanimity, resting in peace. Because after all, think about the things right now from an unawakened point of view, from a grasping point of view, that we would most want to have in our life, and we get them. At some point, we're going to lose them, aren't we? And so there's inherent disappointment in that initial excitement. But it's that initial excitement that we crave because we're self-establishing with the what we hope is not bland. What we hope is exciting, it's stimulating, it's distracting. That's why we crave after it, because it distracts us away from our own understanding. A mind resting in understanding is a mind that is deeply embedded in its own life, literally for the first time, and enjoys the pleasure of what is to be enjoyed, but also enjoys, because it's mindful of it, what is displeasurable, because it understands that it's in its life. That's where life is. Life is in all of it. Life is in the blandness. It's not in the passion.
Well, can it be in both?
As long as there's no self-identification in it.
It's the words.
Now we're getting into semantics.
The words get, you put a judgment on the word, you put a value on the word, and dispassion sounds negative.
Mm-hmm.
Bland seems negative.
Yeah.
But the way I see it is the wisdom you develop, it brings clarity and release from that perversion of what your conditioned mind is doing to kind of drug you. It's a drug. It's a little drip that you need to make yourself comfortable, but it's not clarity.
And that's such a good word. The drug, we drip it. That's obsession, isn't it? That's what drug addiction or that type of addiction, obsession is just that. Resistance obsession.
So when someone is clinging to that word, what's wrong with passion? But there must be another, what you're looking for is not passion. You're looking for joy. You're looking for things that are totally acceptable, but don't cling to it because it's impermanent.
Just recognizing the rising and the passing and not expecting it to be forever, you know.
Yeah, I mean, the show is marvelous.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
the
that's it.
The show is incredible.
Right.
And it doesn't need to be
right.
embellished
it's
at all.
Over, you clap and you go home.
Yeah.
Yep. Even that question, technically, you know, in the framework of the Dhamma, what's wrong with passion is a wrong question.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's already, the inference there is that there's something right with passion.
Right.
You wouldn't ask it.
Mm-hmm. It's a judgment.
Yeah, and again, we're getting into semantics a little bit that I hope to avoid, but sometimes it's unavoidable because we use this language, don't we? So it may be a better answer to the question, what's wrong with passion, is, it's as the Buddha would say, it's the question that's confusing you. Let go of the question. Because then you'll see the underlying true nature of a life that is rooted in dispassion of craving for the things of the world and the experience of the world. That's a true act of practicing restraint, isn't it? To many people, that does seem, the aversion to the first coming up against that does seem way too bland. Like there's going to be nothing left in life to enjoy. But you're taking your joy now not from external ever-changing experiences. You're taking your joy from your own understanding. From looking out on the world moment by moment with understanding. Resting, a mind resting in its body in peace and understanding without the need for anything to be any different than it is. And that's the only way to be fully immersed in your own life. And so, again, I've said this a few times tonight, and not that I don't want to be saying it, it's important. Each and every moment, each and every bland moment is its own reward. Why? Simply because you're in it for the first time. And you're able to stay in it. You're able to fully experience whatever is occurring, which is completely contradictory to most everything else that is taught along those lines. They're taught to avoid it or escape from it, or even by joining to completely ignore it. Simply being present. So, wow, what a great discussion. Ron, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here. Yeah. Back to the old two arrows again.
Yes.
I was looking at how, as Warren said, how difficult it is to see that second arrow going in. funny thing is, it's really easy to see that with other people.
Yeah.
People, I mean, it's like blatant right in front of you.
Yep.
You should always be grateful that people are doing that around you, because you can finally, you know, you get to see it when it's happening right there in the moment.
Yeah, that's right.
You're not distracted by it.
Yeah, sometimes that's what causes our reaction. But
it can be that too. You should always be grateful for people to go through their antics right in front of you. So you can actually get to see it, and then have the honesty to question yourself. Okay, how much of this am I doing?
Okay.
You know, it's kind of a way into understanding that how you plunge in that.
Oh yeah. Yeah. And again, and to other people's, through observing what's going on in the world, as the Buddha did, he looked out on the world is aflame. We can see this ongoing reactive mind reacting to dukkha everywhere. I mean, it's really what is on all the news programs, isn't it? Imagine if
Just walk down the street.
Imagine, and then when you do that, think about if we really could practice restraint and stop that, the reactive stuff that's all out there today that people feel so justified in. Imagine if it was if we just practice restraint and stop reacting. There'd be peace in the world. But the point of the Buddha's Dhamma isn't so much peace in the world, it's peace in our own mind. To bring the ending of conflict within our own mind by stopping that second arrow. So, thank you. Kevin, good to see you tonight.
Good to see you. Nice to see everybody. Really enjoy this sutta. It's sort of, as the Buddha's saying, one who's informed with the Dhamma. You know, this expression of the Eightfold Path and what he said is the samadhi. That's what's how you experience your life. That's enough. You know, you have a calm, peaceful mind in a world that's not that peaceful at times. There's arrows flying around, and you're going to get hit with them, but to be able to have the wisdom to see those moments as they happen and maintain a calm, peaceful mind, that's an expression of this wisdom that we're all learning it while we're in this stream. So that's what it is. I mean, your moment to moment life is pretty calm, whether you're in a traffic jam or whatever else. You're not going to attach to it, and that's a pretty nice place to be. Hear this teaching again a year later.
Yeah, and thank you for that great wisdom. That really is. It's just what it's about. Thank you. Helen, good to see you tonight.
Good to be here, and good to hear this lesson again. I remember the first time I heard it, it was like, whoa. You don't have to do that to yourself. You know, that you are in charge of that arrow.
Yep.
You can just put it right back.
That's it.
Mm. And yeah, put it to better use. But it was very empowering, you know, that it brings together two things, recognizing the rising and passing of something. And in this instance, the rising maybe is the first arrow, and the passing is you letting it go, removing
yes.
it and letting it go, not injecting another arrow into your side. So it's very empowering. And when you are in a situation where maybe someone is provoking you and you recognize that, and you recognize that it's impermanent, they can't go blah, 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 blah forever. And the other thing that I fall back on is the art of war is not to fight. So there's an opportunity to not engage and not participate and not throw an arrow on your side or anyone else's. So it's very empowering. I remember a friend one time talking about how he and his wife had gone out for a walk, and a neighbor caught up with them and started going on and on about their troubles and tribulations and why is this happening to me, relentlessly, until he finally went off on a different path. And my friend just shook his head and said, he must be getting something out of that because he's clinging so hard
wow.
to it. And some people seem to feel at home in chaos.
Mm-hmm. Yep, they've joined with it.
Yeah, and they just surround themselves with it, and sort of like that magnetic game, you know, where you draw a picture and the magnet, all the little iron filings follow wherever your little stencil went. And it's sort of like they have that stencil and they're always drawing in those little iron filings and drawing in the dukkha, because that's their familiar world.
Yeah.
And there's not a whole lot you can do by talking to them, I don't think, as much as showing them and just not being reactive around them. Because if they're trying to engage you and you're not engaging, at some point they're going to run out of steam. And I think sometimes that's one way that you can help them sort of hear maybe what they're saying and where they're stuck.
Yeah.
Without you being, you know, you're sort of more of a mirror than a map, than a megaphone at that point.
That's great. You're not reinforcing their chaotic mind.
Or engaging.
Yeah. And you're right. People that are stuck in that keep recreating the chaotic scenario that just further reinforces their view.
Mm-hmm.
Another way of saying a conditioned mind. Mm-hmm. And that what you said about recognizing the arising and the passing away relates to what Lorna was saying. If we've gone to the past the point of restraint, then the lesson is to take a breath and notice the passing away. Because then you've then seen the whole event. And if we've reacted further, there's always an opportunity to take a breath and notice that at this point, and this might, maybe it's a week later that you've been carrying something around, but notice that it's impermanent. Come back, bring your mind back into your body. Hopefully your meditation practice encourages that, and the framework of the Eightfold Path and this sutta specifically will help you do that. So in that way, you'll learn directly the arising and the passing away.
You know, and sometimes you get those mental worms, like if you wake up in the night for some reason, that's like when anything you didn't even know you were worried about or thinking about becomes this worm that enters your brain and keeps you up. And so I've started to just say, worm, you know, caught you, worm, say out loud, worm. And then the other thing, because humor works with me, the other thing is, if I realize that I'm involved in mental fabrications, I just start to call them figments, mental figments, because I think that sounds funnier.
Yeah,
but it's just the same thing. So those are some little things that I'm pulling out of my bag of tricks lately.
It's a great bag of tricks. Thank you, Ellen. Mary, good to see you. How are you?
Good to be here. Good to see everyone. Oh, I feel like this sutta just, I'm thinking about many things right now, but it does remind me that, like, at the basis of a lot of this is humility. You know, if you can find humility in what you're doing, which is, I don't know, maybe easier for some people. But, you know, it's the opposite of the I-making. It's the opposite of making something about you. It's the opposite of wanting things to be different than they are because of the way you see things or think about. Or it's the opposite of the conditioned mind or the biases that you've learned. You know, and it all applies to me. Oh, but anyway, it's
that's sort of I making in a good way.
Oh, awareness, the first step. But anyway, I looked at humility as anchoring, right? If you had the anchor, you would be turning off into these other things, or responding or reacting, or inserting your passion or your opinion or your thought that things should be different than they are, you know, whatever. So, you know, I may say this after each time, but lots to learn, you know, more work to be done. But a very helpful sutta, very practical.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you. That word humility is often, we often have aversion to that too, don't we? And it's simply, the root of the word humility is humus, not humus, but humus. And it simply means down to earth, which means we're in our bodies, our minds in our bodies, on the planet where we're supposed to be. True humility is the essence of awakening too. Thank you. Russ, good to see you tonight. How are you?
I'm good, thanks.
Good.
I just enjoyed this session and also all the comments. Learned a lot.
Yeah.
Probably had a couple of wows in there.
Yeah, I agree.
So it's good.
Yeah, it is. Thank you. What a song. Liz, good to see you.
Good to see you. Good to be here. This is one of my favorite suttas, and I like how Dave brought in the idea of clarity.
Yeah.
And I think that that's a really important connection to make. Because there's a certain amount of peacefulness that comes with clarity. You're not clinging to anything around you, but seeing things for what they are and letting them sort of fall into place.
Yeah.
So that's all good.
Yeah, thank you. And David, did I call on you? I can't remember.
You did.
Okay. that word clarity is the right word, isn't it? We see things, when you see things clearly, there's no reaction. Mm-hmm. Why would there be?
You see dependent origination in a very slowed down manner, and the sutta is simply, it encapsulates that.
Yeah.
You said the feedback loop. In regards to this sutta, where does that fit in the teaching of what Siddhartha discovered, what he saw? Where is that in the placement in where this would occur?
I'm not following.
The feedback loop that he...
Oh, within the sutta itself. Well, the sutta, that feedback loop would be within the uninformed person who keeps looking, and also relating back to last week's sutta, keeps looking for understanding where it can't be, and specifically getting caught in the feedback loop of a misunderstanding of dukkha leading to practices and beliefs that only continue that, stuck in that feedback loop. It's all rooted in self-referential views, rooted in ignorance of the way things truly are.
It just happens. I mean, that arrow scenario is just...
Continually.
Mm-hmm.
And
your choice...
Yes, and that's the nature of stress. Again, it's just in the last 20 years or so that medical science has really finding out the debilitating effects of stress.
Mm-hmm.
What it is really the second arrow, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And so if we can understand that, if we can see it clearly, we'll stop sticking the second arrow in. By clarity, again, there's nothing magical, mystical, otherworldly about clarity, is it? In fact, if it's established otherworldly, there's no clarity. It's distraction. Well, I'm sorry.
And even when you get stuck with that error, you recognize that arising.
Mm-hmm.
So you recognize it for what it is.
Yes.
Because you're calm.
And you recognize it in an impersonal way because the Buddha has described it as simply dukkha. Sickness, aging, death, not getting what you want, getting what you don't want, five clinging aggregates. It's just part of having a human life.
Like, think of it as an inanimate object. When it becomes animate, it becomes personal.
Yeah, and then you're in trouble. And so, when you don't take any of this personal, and you understand the teachings, you understand what five clinging aggregates are, and going back to last week's teaching, you start wherever you are.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning, no matter how conditioned you are, how reactive you are, how fearful you are, how wonderful you are, how completely balanced you are, you start where you are and you develop the Dhamma. And what does it bring you? It brings you clarity. You see things the way they truly are. And I'm going to say, isn't that enough? It is enough, isn't it? To understand.
We're also creating a physical environment for conditioned mind to start to dissipate just by lowering cortisol levels in our body.
That's right.
Reactions to the central nervous system and how that impacts a reaction in the brain. So if you're able to keep all of those things sort of in a healthy coexistence in your body, you're not stimulating that sharp increase in cortisol, which increases, you know, blood pressure, nervous system, the adrenaline that's released, your adrenal glands are engaged, that fight or flight, you know, instinct.
Yeah.
I think there's a better relationship. You know, it's the idea of all the studies they've done on meditation and what it does for your physical well-being.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. It's the healthiest thing we can do, mentally and physically, is to do this and stop creating the internal systems, the cortisol reactions that are so debilitating and hurtful towards us. It's practical in every single way. You know, again, it's not just escape from dukkha. It's not about a way to feel good. It's a way of living mindfully and as healthy as we possibly can while having this human life. And the foolish question is, well, what do we do after? You know, what do you care? And when we let go of the need of what might happen and live with what is happening, we are free. We are at peace. We are living life as fully as we possibly can, which is something I always wanted. I didn't know how to do it. You know? Now I do. Now I do. And I thought you were going to go a certain direction, Liz, but you didn't. And thank you for what you said. The outer expression of my life is incredibly bland. I mean, it is. And I love it. I wouldn't want it any other way. My dog would like a little more excitement, I think. But again, if somebody said when you're 63, this is going to be your life, I said, and I wouldn't want it to be any other way, because it's quiet and it's peaceful.
Yeah, I get accused of being the most boring person in the world.
And
I don't mind at all.
Yeah, and my life is not boring at all. In fact, there's there literally is too much going on, but not in a hurtful way.
Outside, from the outside, it looks boring.
Yeah, and so it comes down to. I used to have a teacher. I mentioned a few, Arnold Patton. He used to talk about abundance, but his idea of abundance was also tied to a lot of monetary abundance. And he said, you get to the point where you just can't take any more abundance. But that's how it is, you know. And it's not because of, you know, the gravy train keeps rolling past my house. It's just this is amazing. This is life. And on the other hand, and I'm not. This isn't a plea of sympathy. Physically, I'm in not great shape. And that's not to say that I wouldn't want it to be, if I wouldn't want to be 25 again, but I'm not. And so there's no distraction there. It's just, this is life going on. And it's the when I think back, I know I don't talk often about myself, but here I go. When I think back to when I was 15, 16, 18, trying to figure things out and why am I here and what's life all about, it's about this. It's about this. It's about having clarity about what life is all about. Because that's the question I had 40 years ago. But I didn't have any clarity. It's amazing. Bonnie, it's good to see you tonight.
See you soon. I always come back to it. The clarity refers to me. Skillful view.
Yeah.
It relates to everything else. It relates to, if you get the arrow, if you're skillful enough, you can see what arises, accept what arises, so that you can sit and hold it and be with it without having to do anything with it to understand it, and then let it go away. But I think, you know, that's for me, and for people in my world, I think you have to practice. It is simple. Here's the simple structure, but you know, nothing will change unless you behave differently, unless you do those things differently. So the framework just becomes it's ladder, so to speak. You go up, you go down, or sideways, whatever. I see it sort of vertically, and you keep can't talk about one without the other if you want to work it through so that it can't fall away.
Yeah.
But in the midst of the arrow, I think it depends on how deep the arrow gets in or where it gets in and how to then figure out what that means.
Yeah. And thank you. And everything is reconciled back to skillful view or right view. Mm-hmm. From that, as the Buddha describes right view, is simply a profound understanding of the nature of suffering. A few more qualifications. But that's it. That's the difference between an uninformed and an informed person. And this is one well-informed sangha, I can tell you. It's really, really is. It's, what a great discussion again tonight. Yeah, so next week is the Dana dinner on Tuesday night. Has anybody had turkeys or hams to give to?
I will this week.
Oh, great. Great. Yeah, you can just drop them off anytime they're open.
Do you have to call before you go?
I already let Julie know we'd be doing it. So again, whenever they're open, you could just drop it off. And they have. She said they have big freezers there.
Right.
I don't think there's anything else to talk about the Dana dinner. It starts at 6. And again, we're going to have a class here Monday night. I'll send the newsletter goes out, the email goes out every Monday, and I'll just announce it there. But we will have a class here on Monday night. And we'll finish with metta, as we always do. So again, find your meditation posture, relaxed meditation posture. Become mindful of your in-breath and your out-breath. And these are the Buddha's words on metta from the Karaniya Metta Sutta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing, in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight. Peace. Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.